The good news is I have very little to report, okay? I mean, the good news is not much is going on right now except good stuff. The news is all at least 51% good. But be that as it may, I'm going to run through these slides fairly quickly, and then, as always, we'll save some time for questions and conversation. Let me start out with just kind of a quick snapshot of how we ended up in the fall semester. We still don't have the final certified enrollment data, but what is on the coordinating board website as of the 20th class day, which is the preliminary count for all the institutions, shows us with 11,152, which no matter how you measure it, that'll drop some when we get to our certified, but this is still a record year. And so we have now had two successive fall semesters with record high enrollment. I think the thing that is so impressive this year, this fall in particular, is while our growth rate leveled, well, it didn't level off, it decreased slightly from last year. We were up in the 12% range last year. We are still showing 8.48% growth year to year over fall 2010. And that compares with statewide growth in the student body of 2.47%. So we are more than three times the state rate of growth. Now, again, that's a mixed bag of news. I mean, it's great news for the institution. It shows that our reputation is growing. We're getting more students, but we're getting better students. It does continue to place stresses and strains on all of our facilities and all of our people. But again, given your choice of problems, this is the one you want to have. We are the fifth fastest growing university in the state of Texas. And I knock a couple of those out because I don't consider them fair competitors. A&M San Antonio and U of H Victoria both did downward expansion this year, so they, you know, in one semester added a freshman and sophomore class. So they're up in the, you know, 15 and 20% range. Well, we're not in that category, but still, in a fair fight, you know, we're actually closer to like third fastest growing in the state of Texas. So you all are doing something right. I mentioned not just rate of growth, but quality of growth. Our six-year graduation rate showed an 18% jump during the current year. And our first-time full-time retention rate, these are round numbers, showed a jump of about 6%. These are big numbers. These are very important numbers, and these are the numbers that both the public is looking at and our coordinating board and system and, you know, the legislature, basically. Everyone wants to measure performance, and these are the kinds of things that they're looking at. So the news is good in terms of the fall semester. Thank you all for accommodating the growth, and thank you all for giving and continuing to give students a high quality of service. More and more, that's our reputation. We're the university that cares. We're the university that returns phone calls. We're the university that untangles red tape. So that's a niche for us. And in addition to academic, everyone says they're excellent academically, and we all are, right? But we don't all have the same level of commitment to service that I see every day practiced at this institution. Moving on, a couple of quick summaries of things that took place in November at the Board of Regents meeting. We had three academic programs and one renaming request that were up for consideration. We received authority for preliminary planning for our MS in computational science. Now, you all recall, and I think I mentioned this at the last update, that we had put forward a PhD proposal in computational science last spring. It also received board approval. It is being held, in abeyance, I guess, in suspense at the coordinating board. There's not a hard moratorium on new doctoral programs, but there is a soft moratorium on new doctoral programs. So we talked to people at the coordinating board. We believe they're going to be much more open to an MS rather than the PhD in computational science. We still hope to go forward with a computational science doctoral program within 3 to 5 years, but this will lay a strong foundation. Continues to be a great proposal. We had NSF Day here on Monday, and we talked a little bit to the people from NSF about this. They're excited about it. It's interdisciplinary. It's all the things that are current in this field. The next two have to do with really renaming, and these are not brand new degree programs. These are new names for existing degree programs. But when you go through the process, you don't just rename a degree. You give back a degree, and then you request a new one. So that's the category that these two fall into. And finally, the College of Well, what 6 months ago was the College of Business and Technology, and then for the last few weeks has been the College of Business, will very soon be the College of Business and Entrepreneurship. And that's pending coordinating board approval. This should be completely non-controversial, and it's just a matter of getting the approval. It does, however, reflect kind of the current state of the discipline in business, and it is all about entrepreneurship. It's all about starting small businesses and creating value. So this really reflects both the focus and the direction of the programs in that college. Also, Dr. R.N. Singh was named as our Regents Professor for 2010-2011. An honor that he richly deserved. And he was down there for the dinner, and it really was a very moving and a meaningful evening, and an honor for him. Last time, we talked about how we're handling the growth. Because of the way we are funded in the state of Texas with the biennial budget, you tend not to get all the money for growth until 2 years after the growth actually occurs. However, we do have additional revenue from overrealized designated tuition, and we are plowing almost all of that back into new faculty lines. And you see here, and I know Dr. Lemansky has shared this information with deans and department heads, 25 brand new faculty lines. We have 33 existing lines which are vacant. And so the big push now is to get all of those lines filled, or as many of them as we can, during the current year. We have a lot of searches underway. Dr. Romero, our new Associate VP for Diversity and Equal Opportunity, is helping manage those searches. I would remind everyone involved in this, first of all, thank you. Doing high-quality searches is hard work. It's very time-consuming. But as my good friend Gary Peer once told me, and many of you know Gary, there's nothing more important that we do as academic managers and academic administrators or faculty members, nothing more important than hiring good people. Because when you hire the right person, that person is the one who will take the college, the program, the department, the entire university forward. You hire the wrong person, you're going to pay for it for years and years. So I appreciate in advance all the time that will be invested in these searches. It is extremely important work. It is very painstaking and time-consuming and laborious, but nothing we do is more important. We do have new procedures and guidelines, and as you'll see from the little asterisk on here, if you go to the HR website, you'll see the forms, and all of that will be outlined there for you. Please consult with your department head, your dean, with the provost. Have any questions about the process, because doing this many searches in 1 year is going to be an enormous undertaking, but it has the capability to absolutely transform the institution. We had a number of students participating last week at the 9th Annual Pathways Student Research Symposium in College Station. We had 65 students and 9 faculty going there from A&M Commerce. And as you see here, 450 students and 150 faculty from across the entire system. This is one of those system activities which is truly a shining light. They do this so well. It brings so much recognition to a very hard-working group of students, and it's a great way to sort of cultivate talent and encourage high-performing students to continue working hard and to continue setting high expectations for themselves and their colleagues. We brought home the traveling trophy. And there it is. This is the trophy that goes to the university that has the most awards for posters and oral presentations. So congratulations to Dr. Headley, and congratulations to everyone who represented us so well in College Station. It's nice to get noticed for the right things, isn't it? I always shudder when I see the university in the paper, but this is good stuff. This is the right reason to be recognized. Last week, we had our first ever Global E-Learning Summit. Many of you participated in that. I'd like to recognize Dr. Rusty Waller for his leadership and everyone else who helped make that a success. Thank you so much. This was the first first successful attempt to stage this conference. Next year, it'll be bigger and better, and the theme of next year's conference is globalization in the arts and humanities. Did I get that right, Dr. Waller? Okay. And I don't know if the call for papers has gone out yet, but it'll go out soon. Well, you know, any of you who have been involved in planning events like this know that the minute this year's event is over, planning for next year's event begins. This is a university-wide activity. It is directly and intimately connected with our quality enhancement plan. So be thinking about topics you'd like to see, contributions you'd like to make. The call will go out far and wide, and it's very exciting to host this kind of a conference right here at A&M Commerce. I'd also like to announce our December commencement speaker, Mr. Noah Nelson. Mr. Nelson was a 1973 graduate of East Texas State. He went on to be a news anchor and correspondent for NBC News, and those of you who are of my generation will remember Noah Nelson, having seen him on TV. And he's visited campus a couple of times. We have talked with him about the possibility of his joining us as sort of a distinguished lecturer. He's very excited about doing that. He wants to get back to Texas. He lives in Los Angeles. You've got a picture of him here. He has a wonderful story to tell. He has this deep baritone voice. He still does voiceovers. In fact, I'm sure you've heard his voice, even though you may not know where it was coming from. But he was the first African-American student at East Texas State to have an Anglo roommate. You think, well, so what? Well, so it is no big deal now. At the time, it was considered groundbreaking. And I asked him, well, what was that like? And he said, well, it was interesting. His roommate drove a red Dodge Dart painted up in the colors of the American flag. And he said, so he was noticed when he drove around Commerce. And I said, well, I'm sure there's more stories to tell, but save him for now. Anyway, he's a delightful man, and we're looking forward to welcoming him back to our campus. A quick update on our institutional effectiveness and planning position. We are in the process, final stages of the process of interviewing for this person. We have scheduled 4 interviews. 2 have been completed. We have 1 tomorrow and 1 right after that. So the recommendations coming from the committee will be made soon thereafter. This position, each day that we don't fill it, it is more critically needed than the day before, particularly since we are at the point that we were in our SACS reaffirmation cycle. So the 2 candidates that have visited so far, very different, both very highly qualified. I really commend Mr. Brown and everyone on the committee for the work they put into this search. As I have observed over the last 2 years, and I've shared with you before, it's a tremendous time to be recruiting talent right now. There's a lot of great people out there, and more, there are a lot of people who want to come to A&M Commerce. They've noticed, for example, that we haven't missed a year for merit raises this year. They've noticed that our enrollment is growing. They've noticed that we're continuing to develop and expand our academic programs, even during the current constrained economic circumstances. So, again, that's a testament to the great work that all of you are doing in helping get our reputation spread far and wide. And since we're talking about institutional effectiveness, just a quick little reminder. This is like the little alarm that goes off on your iPhone. Institutional or effective reports are now due. In fact, at this point, they're past due in Weave Online. And Dr. Waller is coordinating the efforts of the Institutional Effectiveness Committee, and they are reviewing those reports now. I know that we have identified some gaps. We can still do this. In fact, we're going to do this because we got to do this. But if you have some gaps pointed out to you, please work with the committee, work with the experts in institutional effectiveness, and we'll get through this in one piece, I assure you. This year we'll get through it. Next year we're going to be exemplary. It's the kind of thing that properly engaged will help us do what we want to do, and that is make this institution better next year than it is this year, and to keep up that pace for the rest of our careers. Let me give a quick update. I think most of those who are affected already have heard this information on low-producing programs. I hate that term, low-producing programs. Why don't we call it highly selective low-enrollment programs, something like that? I don't know. High-quality programs which attract only the elite few. But that's not what the coordinating board calls it. The coordinating board calls it low-producing programs. They have very strict numerical objective criteria for measuring these programs, and I'm going to have to be careful not to editorialize because I'm a state employee. But sometimes when you look just at numerical objective criteria, you miss other aspects of curricular value that may not be reflected in the numbers. Well, believe me, that's not an argument that goes very far in the current environment. So our task is to get our numbers up. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Austin appearing and appealing and beseeching and groveling before the coordinating board. And there is an appeals process where if your program is marked for extinction, you do have the opportunity at the end of the process to appear before the coordinating board and explain to them why you would like to have not an exemption exactly, but sort of a two-year extension. Okay, in other words, two more years to work to try to get the numbers up where they are. We were able to secure that in advance of the actual appeal for our MS in mathematics, and as a result of the appeals that were heard that day, we also got two-year extensions for our sociology and Spanish degrees, our master's degrees in those fields. I could talk for a long time about why these are important degrees, but I think you're a pretty easy audience on that. I don't need to convince you of that. They are critical. You know, when we are talking about trying to graduate more students and more prospective teachers in STEM fields, you can't do that without a graduate degree in mathematics. When we're trying to become a Hispanic-serving institution, when you have seen Steve Murdoch's presentation, which I have seen twice in the last month, and I've lost count of how many times I've seen it over the last 20 years. But if you don't know who Steve Murdoch is, he's the one that's been doing analysis of the changing demographics of Texas for two decades now. And the trends that he pointed out in the 90s are, if anything, speeding up. We are now a majority-minority state. Hispanics are the fastest-growing segment of the population. And they're going to take away our master's degree in Spanish when we're trying to become Hispanic-serving and we're trying to graduate. We're trying to attract prospective teachers, both Spanish teachers and bilingual educators, into our pipeline. So those efforts are bolstered by having this degree, even though right now the numbers are not what they should be. Okay, enough on that. Sociology, okay, I said enough on that. In any event, we got the temporary extensions. We've met with the department heads, the provost and the deans, and they know what they need to do. So I have a lot of faith in everyone's efforts to roll up their sleeves and make it happen. These goals are achievable, but unfortunately will not achieve themselves. Well, let me talk a little bit about what's going on at the system. Our leader, this is, by the way, the a snapshot of the photo I have hanging on the wall in my office right now, just to remind me, who I work for. Our new chancellor has now been on the job about 6 weeks. Some of you got to meet him when he was here for our music building dedication and residence hall dedication on the 21st. He's not the kind of guy who sits around and frets a lot when he sees things that need to happen. He has already done some bold decision-making. He has reorganized things. He brought in a transition team that worked very quickly to come up with some recommendations on system reorganization. And I'll just kind of tick through those. These don't impact us directly, but they do impact us. He has created a new position. If we go to the next slide, a vice chancellor for recruitment and diversity. This is a brand new position, and it was recommended by the transition team. And our very own Frank Ashley will go into that position soon. We don't know exactly the date of it. Dr. Ashley, of course, all of us know him. All of us would like to get him back in commerce, but he has important work still to do in College Station. A new vice chancellor position has been created also for federal and state relations, and this will take the place of the position that was had been titled Vice Chancellor for Government Relations, held by Dr. Stanton Calvert. Dr. Calvert will be retiring, and Mr. Guy Diedrich will be moving into the federal and state relations position. A person in Washington has been identified for the federal half, and a search will be conducted for the state half of the job. The business operations have been shifted around. I won't go into detail on this, but under the previous shared services arrangement, the business officer for the system had split duties with A&M College Station, the university. It was the recommendation of the transition team that there was no real economy in that. There was an appearance of efficiency, but not a reality. So they have separated those functions and divided the duties accordingly among existing personnel. Also, I've mentioned Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. This is the position that Dr. Ashley currently holds. He will vacate that position, and a search will be conducted for a new Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs. And that's in the early stages. We don't have any information exactly on timeline or a direction for, focus for them. I think the most exciting thing for me that's going on right now at the system level has to do with the initiatives that are being undertaken by the Committee on Academic and Student Affairs under our new regent, now not brand new, but I guess he's been at two meetings now, Elaine Mendoza of San Antonio. Some of you met Regent Mendoza when she toured campus here last summer. She brings a lot of energy to the role. She brings a real sense of purpose to this committee. And what she does, which I appreciate in particular, is that she brings a real spirit of initiative and innovation. She clearly sees her role as committee chair not as a regulator or a compliance officer, but rather as that of a leader who helps us do our best. And toward that end, she has created three separate task forces. One is working on student success metrics. One is working on learning outcomes. And we talked about these briefly last time. Ricky Dobbs and Maria Hinojosa are both are serving on, respectively, those two task forces. And I know, Ricky, I know you've been busy. You've been meeting both in person and TTVN. And Maria, if you're here as well, I know that they've been putting you through the paces in those. She just recently created a P16 task force, which will look at university-school relationships. A broad charge, and I'll be co-chairing that task force with President Maria Ferrier from A&M San Antonio. So that one is being in the process of being composed. These are all very forward-looking groups, and in fact, we had a conference call with Regent Mendoza this morning, and she said her goal is to make a bold statement about all the great things that are going on within the A&M system, within individual institutions, and to demonstrate the value that all of our institutions bring to the people of the state of Texas, and to continually challenge us not just to do our jobs, but to do our jobs better and better. So it's an exciting time. This is the first time I've seen that attitude, I guess, is the best way to describe it, that approach on the Academic and Student Affairs Committee. And we're all responding positively and energetically to it. Real quickly, let me close out with a couple of thoughts here on where we're headed as we plan for the next fiscal year, 2013, FY2013. Of course, that'll be the second year of the biennium, so we know how much money we're going to have. Of course, we thought we knew how much money we were going to have for the second year of the last biennium. Turns out we had less. But I don't think that's going to happen. I'm not going to make any projections. My crystal ball is pretty muddy on this point, but right now, the state economy is improving. It's not improving in a revolutionary way, but sales tax collections are up. Unemployment is not improving greatly, but at least not getting any worse. So it's likely that the next legislature will have more money, slightly more money, and it's also, again, anything can happen any day. I haven't checked on the state of Greek sovereign debt in the last couple of hours. But barring an unanticipated disaster, we know what we're going to get next year. We can probably count on 3-5% enrollment growth. And that's what I'm asking the Budget Review and Development Council to adopt as its planning assumption. 3% probably is the conservative figure, which will probably take as the planning figure. I think the thing that we need to keep in mind, and this is going to have an effect on the ground level in the way we do business, is, and this has been coming for a long time, but I think it's finally going to happen. In the 82nd legislature, a piece of legislation was passed called House Bill 9, HB 9, which requires the coordinating board to develop a methodology for allocating up to 10% of our total appropriations based on measurable outcomes. Again, this has been being talked about for at least a decade, probably longer. But it's right. I mean, it's now law, and now we're at the point where the discussion is how are we going to do it, not whether we're going to do it. Now, there's still a lot of discussion that needs to take place, but the measurable outcomes that are being discussed are the ones that I've listed here. Retention, fall-to-fall retention. Well, we saw a boost in those numbers. Graduation rates, tremendous amount of controversy over how you measure graduation rates, and I'm not going to get into that with you now. But if you look at six-year graduation rates, you're really measuring the quality of your entering class 6 years ago. Yeah, I mean, you're looking at advising and all the things that you're doing to help students be successful now, but the biggest determinant occurred 6 years ago. So a lot of discussion about that. Time to degree is very important. The legislature, all of our elect, and the public, want us to shorten the amount of time that students spend on campus. They want them to get in and get out with a minimum number, preferably no excess classes taken. Critical need fields, STEM fields, of course, nursing. Our nursing program will play right into this, and teacher preparation. These are all critical need areas. The more students we graduate in these critical need fields, the heavier they will count in the formula, whatever formula is finally devised. And finally, there will be consideration given for at-risk students. Not a problem for us. We've been educating at-risk students since 1889. I don't know that at-risk is the best descriptor, but let's call them first generation. Let's call them students who come from families where college going is not a tradition. But we're good at that. We can always do better, but this is built into our mission. A couple of other planning assumptions real quickly. We are going to face some increased operating costs next year. These are things we don't have any control over. We will be instructed by the system to shoulder, the institution will shoulder a greater portion of the burden of group health care insurance. We will need to be very careful in tuition remissions and exemptions. We are, particularly in the area of veterans affairs, we're getting a lot of returning veterans, which is a good thing, but there's a financial obligation that goes with those and with Hazelwood and all of the veterans' benefits. And finally, we're being instructed to set aside a greater portion of our operating budget for deferred maintenance. And this is going to be about $500,000 a year for the next 3 years. So all of these things are going to have to be stirred into the pot when we put together the budget. We are very likely going to be asked to, well, be authorized to raise a combination of designated tuition and fees with a 3.95% cap. This is modest. I wouldn't want to raise it any more than that, even if we had authority to do that. If we've been going up at a steady clip. I was looking at some numbers on this, by the way, just this morning, in fact. And we are in the bottom third in terms of institutions that have raised tuition over the last 10 years, or 8 years, I guess, since tuition was deregulated in 2003. Now, we're at 65%. That's a lot in 8 years. But we've got institutions well over 100%, considerably more than doubled their tuition in the last 8 years. So we're still where we need to be, kind of in the bottom third, but we're going to have to be careful that we not start creeping up, because our students, as all of you know, are very, very cost sensitive. And I know we were talking yesterday at Executive Council about the fact that our transfer population seems to be decreasing. It's strictly a matter of cost. You can get the same hours at the community college for half the price. I'm going to put off transfer in as long as I possibly can. That creates problems for us as advisors, as degree planners, but it's just a financial reality. Finally, we will be doing the forced reallocation as we've done the last two budget cycles, and that's where the new money is going to come from. That's where our innovation money is going to come from. Our expansion and growth money. That's it. That's our source of new funding for the coming year. I know it's a difficult process. I know that there's a lot of horse trading that goes on behind closed doors, but it's working. It's working because you all are engaging the process with goodwill and you know, a view toward the higher gifts, as they say. Finally, some future directions. These are things which we've been talking about for some time. They're no longer squarely in the future, but in this case, the future is now. We have now successfully launched our programs with academic partnerships. We have healthy enrollment in our three programs, and we have prospects for, I think, pretty robust growth in the next year to 18 months. This spring, we will launch the first fully online EDD in educational administration. And I think this program is really going to take the state by storm. I was at a conference last week, and the colleague at Academic Partnerships was on the panel. And a community college trustee got up and kind of started pounding the podium and says, "I want our faculty to get PhDs or doctoral degrees of some kind. They can't leave their jobs to do it, and they can't afford to go to the University of Phoenix and pay $50,000 to $75,000. When is the public sector, when are public universities going to come up with an online degree that they can afford?" And our friend at Academic Partnership says, "You're not going to have to wait much longer. We got one coming in the spring. I'm not going to tell you who it is just yet, but we hear you and we're responding." So this is a great new direction for us to go in. He also said something else that that I know the faculty take to heart, and that is that in all of these programs, those things which mean the most to the academy are squarely owned by the academy. The academic rigor, the curriculum, the quality of instruction, the learning outcomes, and last but far from least, the selection of faculty. All of those things are untouched. We have the same 100% control that we have with all of our internal online programs and all of our face-to-face programs. What we are talking about is marketing, retention, and student support. So, anyway, it's a changing market, but I applaud so many of you who have embraced this and not just dealt with change but gotten out in front of it, because that's where we're headed, not just at this university but in higher education generally. MS and global e-learning, same speech applies there. Another great new market, another great new opportunity, and, of course, we continue to expand our overseas markets. And in January, we'll have 160 Korean students being bused from DFW to spend the next 3 years in Cal Hill, Texas. So that's very exciting. Let me close with a couple of things here. I want to share this quotation. I ran across this quotation from Abraham Lincoln, not only one of my favorite presidents, but one of my favorite writers. "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty. We must rise to the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew." Well, he was talking about the Civil War. Now, we're not facing that kind of challenge, I hope. We're also not facing the same kind of scary funding crisis that we were anticipating 12 months ago. As you will recall, I certainly recall, when we had this update 12 months ago and the 82nd legislature was still a couple of months away, it was pretty frightening. Now, does that mean the funding challenges are over? No, not at all. Funding challenges are serious, and we're going to have to continue to do everything we can to stretch the value of the resources that we have entrusted to our care. But we're not looking at a crisis situation. Nonetheless, the game has changed. We're in a different environment. The expectations continue to get higher and higher, both on the part of the public, on the part of our students, on the part of their families, on the part of our elected officials, our leadership. We have to step up our game. And the change in some areas will be incremental. In other areas, it will be profound. So, again, it's not just dealing with change. It is embracing change and making sure that the things that are happening redound to our advantage and not to our detriment. I'd like to open it up for questions. We've got a few minutes.
For the programs that we have been granted the 2-year extension, Do we get another look in 2 years, or does that just mean we have two more years and those programs disappear?
I guess I'll have to answer that. I was looking for backup on this. It's that second thing. Yeah, we don't get another bite of the apple. It's kind of up or out for those programs. It was very clear, both in terms of the guidelines and in terms of the informal conversation, that they don't want to see me back at the table in 2 years begging for another extension.
Okay, so for those programs, are we looking at any partnership with other universities to continue to offer that level of education to students who might want to pursue a graduate degree here?
We're trying to continue the programs here as they are. So the idea is to just bring up the enrollment to where it needs to be within the next year, year and a half.
That's not what he just said, right? Didn't you say 2 years, they're gone?
In 2 years, you begin phasing them out. So whoever is in the program, if the program shuts down in 2 years, we continue to carry forward the people who are in it until they graduate. We're obligated to do that.
Okay. So I guess my main concern is, if they're low-producing programs, pardon the term, since they use that, if we're going to continue to have doctoral programs here in other areas that do produce, those students need to be able to research in other languages and to find knowledge that's out there. So I was just curious if we're looking at ways to still bring assistance to them in their programs so they can continue their education and stay here and not have to go somewhere else to gather that. So thanks.
Well, regarding those programs, they will be able to finish the degree here, if that was what your question was on the ones that we just mentioned. Those programs are on the way up, I think. As was mentioned, when the president made an argument for them, there was some evidence to indicate that we were doing better in the last couple of years. And he very elegantly, I have to say, presented that in such a way that we were the only university that had 100% approval, I believe, that day. So, I think it was well done. There are some other programs that were low producing also, but we got an exemption on. One is physics. And it turns out that with physics, we got the two-year extension. And in looking at physics compared to the other physics programs in the Texas A&M University system, we have a much larger and more robust program here than any other university, except, of course, for College Station. So I think there we're talking about partnering, though, with some of the other system universities, so that we can offer joint degree, either joint degree programs, or students can take courses at some of the other universities, maybe, and we can work through us to get their degrees. So these are some things that we're talking about right now for joining forces with some of the other Texas A&M University system schools, as well as some other non-Texas A&M University system schools.
Okay. Part of the reason that I was concerned when I saw Spanish on there, that's pretty much the only language we offer to students here now. You have, I think the honors have Italian that they can take, but with the push on globalization, I guess maybe I confuse the look sometimes, but perception means a lot to some people. But if we're a globalization-focused university and we don't have any graduate languages, to me that seems a little contradictory. And I know the intent isn't just on everybody being able to speak another language, but as we send students abroad and travel, I know that English is the dominant language in the world, and being in the military, I see that everywhere. But it would be nice if our students could continue to learn and contribute in other nations, not necessarily just in English. So, okay, thanks.
We're right with you on that, by the way. Dr. Hendricks and I and some students visited a new charter school in Dallas this morning that has currently enrolled about 150 students, and they offer Spanish, Latin, and Mandarin. So these are the students who are headed our way, we hope.
If I could add just one thing about the Spanish. When the president made the argument, I think the commissioner was very impressed by the fact that, this is something that's going to be useful, a very useful sort of thing for us to be able to continue. And so, one of the things we promised, the president promised on behalf of the university, is that we're going to work very, very hard to live up to the expectations of this board of actually meeting, you know, meeting those enrollment standards. And so that's something that we're going to challenge the deans and department heads, and all of us are going to work very, very hard to try to do, because we don't want to, the president doesn't want to have to go there and, well, you're not going to go there. He won't be going there in 2 years. We'll, you know, if it doesn't make it, you know, we'll have to drop it. But we don't want to drop these programs. They're very, I agree, they're very important to us.
I'm going to sense that you all are pretty much in agreement with everything we've said by your silence.
Oh, one other thing. Just one other thing. On the statistics for the new faculty positions, there was a slight error on the slide. There are actually 30 new positions, and the reason it had 25, I don't know if you remember that, is that the president had provided 5 positions earlier that actually was left off of the slide. So there are actually 30 new positions and a few over 30 existing open positions. So we're actually going to be recruiting for over 60 new faculty members. That's a pretty exciting prospect, and certainly that can change a university quite a bit.
Okay, well, thank you all very much for coming out. Have a great Thanksgiving.